Live from our nation's capital.
How do we reopen this economy?
The latest on how this pandemic is impacting farmers.
What does this do for the United States' relationship with China?
Bloomberg Sound On. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
We're responding to this crisis, and manufacturers are stepping up like never before.
We're looking at 70 candidates for different vaccines.
How do we make sure a pandemic of this scale never happens again?
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
1 week till the election, we check in with Jordan Fabian, Bloomberg White House reporter, and COVID fear is back and driving markets. John Authors, Bloomberg opinion columnist and senior editor for Markets, weighs in on what happened in the markets today. And next hour, Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat representing Virginia's 7th Congressional District. COVID relief, digital divide, and broadband during the pandemic. Lots to get through. Where did the time go? 1 week. 1 week until November 3rd, the election. The big enchilada. What can I get away with? Jordan Fabian, Bloomberg White House reporter. Jordan, how did President Trump spend the day today on the campaign trail?
Well, Kevin, he started off just now with a rally in Lansing, Michigan. He's going to head to Nebraska later on, and as well as Wisconsin. Wisconsin, a state that, of course, he won back in 2016 along with Michigan. And the Nebraska stop could help him shore up a single electoral vote in Nebraska, which divides its electoral votes by congressional district and not the whole state. So he's
what do you mean by that? That's interesting. Tomorrow. Let's go there. What does that mean?
So that means that, the electoral votes are apportioned by congressional district. So if a candidate wins the congressional district, then they can split the electoral vote. So let's say Joe Biden wins Nebraska's 2nd district, where President Trump is heading right now. He can win one of Nebraska's 5 electoral votes.
Okay, that's fascinating. They're also doubling down on Florida and Pennsylvania. I spoke to a source earlier this afternoon who said they're still confident about Pennsylvania. You've got this unrest happening in Philadelphia. They feel they're overperforming in Philadelphia, the actual city, compared to Hillary Clinton. What do we know about Pennsylvania?
Well, I can tell you, Kevin, they are certainly spending a lot of time there. I was with the president yesterday where he did 3 rallies in Pennsylvania. In the northeastern part of the state, in Allentown, central part of the state, in Lancaster, and then in Altoona, in the western part of the state. So, that's a state that carries a lot of electoral votes. The president thinks he's got a good message on fracking and energy after what Joe Biden said in the final debate about transitioning away from the oil industry. And so they're going to try to press their advantage there as one of the key states they're focusing on.
Okay. Meanwhile, Joe Biden also returning to the campaign trail. The Biden campaign is trying to expand the map. What states do they have their eyes on?
Well, I think they're trying to rebuild that blue wall in the Midwest, Kevin, that the president battered in 2016. So they're looking at some of the same states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, of course, and Pennsylvania, which is right next to the vice president's home state of Delaware. But also expanding the map in places like Arizona and Georgia, where the vice president was today. They think that with the influx of migrants from the north and some of the growth that Democrats have in the suburbs in those states, they can have a chance of winning those traditionally red states.
It's just going to be absolutely fascinating. Jordan Fabian's online, Bloomberg White House reporter. 7 days out, I guess six days and some hours out until Election Day. The president today telling reporters that he doesn't necessarily believe, or he believes that there should be a result on election night. Jordan, what do we know about how the White House is preparing and how the Biden campaign is preparing for potentially not having a result on election night?
Well, they're certainly gearing up for a possible legal battle, Kevin, and they're already fighting that in courts in many states. The Trump campaign fighting some battles in courts in Pennsylvania and Nevada over mail-in ballots and poll watchers, and they're certainly assembling a legal team for any battles that might ensue afterwards. But I got to say, Kevin, this is a bit of a misnomer by the president. You know, news organizations will often call the result on election night, but in closely contested states, year after year, we see results not being decided formally for days, if not weeks afterwards. So while, yes, there are certainly states that are relying on mail-in ballots much more so than in the past because of the pandemic, it's not really true to say that the election is always decided on election night.
All right, and it's not just Joe Biden and President Trump who are hitting the campaign trail. It's also former President Barack Obama. Obama was in Orlando, Florida, earlier today, and he talked about the economy. Take a listen to former President Obama talking about the economy. Here he is.
The economic damage that he inflicted by botching the pandemic response means he will be the first president since Herbert Hoover to actually lose jobs.
So what's driving the closing argument? Is it COVID-19 for Joe Biden? Is it the economy for Trump? What is it?
Right, Kevin, you said it. It's definitely the COVID-19 pandemic and Trump's handling of it for Joe Biden. They're arguing that he has botched this response and their country has suffered as a result. While you're seeing the president really downplay the pandemic by saying, you know, COVID, it's all the media is talking about, and trying to get voters to focus on some of what his successes before the pandemic, and also trying to paint Democrats as too far to the left. And so those are the messages you'll hear from the nominees here in the final days.
Jordan, I'm in my Bloomberg terminal right now, and I've got a map of the United States pulled up, and it's red and it's blue. And no, it's not an electoral college map. It's a map of COVID-19 hospitalizations, which shows that those hospitalizations are rising. Diving into the terminal, COVID-19 hospitalizations have risen at least 10% in the past week in 32 states and the nation's capital as the month-old viral surge increasingly weighs on America's healthcare system. Current hospitalizations soared 68%, wow, in New Mexico, 50% in Wyoming, and 38% in Connecticut. Among other notable increases, South Dakota, Montana, and North Dakota have the most current patients per capita. Jordan, I'm fascinated by this. I know we don't have an answer. We're not going to have an answer until weeks, potentially months, dare I say years after, in terms of how COVID-19 at the local level is going to impact turnout on election day. There's been obviously a dramatic increase in early election voting. 50 million Americans already casting their ballots. I spoke with a source today who suggested to me, hey, those folks casting ballots were also likely to show up at the polls on November 3rd. It's going to be just riveting, and one of the narratives of election night, to really look into whether or not first-time voters or returning voters or disenfranchised voters cast a mail-in ballot, or if these were the folks who were going to vote all along, Jordan.
Yeah, no, you're right, Kevin. Those are going to be interesting things to watch, but the trends right now are showing the early voting levels far surpassing what they were in 2016 and even in 2018 when Democrats saw a surge of turnout. And it's generally believed that larger turnout is better for the Democratic candidate. If Hillary Clinton had seen larger turnout in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in 2016, she likely would have won. So I think the Democrats look at those numbers and they are encouraged by them. But we'll have to see, of course, if this year proves to be different and you also have Republicans voting early in large numbers because of the pandemic, too. We'll only find that out on election night or afterwards.
Jordan, great point. That's a great point. Are the Eagles going to beat the Cowboys this weekend?
The Cowboys look pretty bad on Sunday, Kevin, against Washington. So you got to think the Eagles.
Have you seen the start to our season? But I mean, yeah, we had that big win last week. But I mean, sometimes I don't even know what I'm watching. But Boston Scott has my full, undivided loyalty. Jordan Fabian, Bloomberg White House reporter. Where are you headed to next, buddy?
We'll see, Kevin. The president's got a lot of stops in the coming days. So I'm sure I'll be out there for one of them. And it'll be certainly one of the swing states for sure.
Yeah, pack the Purell. All right, Jordan, stay safe. Jordan Fabian, Bloomberg White House reporter. Download the Bloomberg Sound On podcast on Apple iTunes at Bloomberg.com or by downloading the Bloomberg Business app. You can also find me on Bloomberg Radio, iHeartRadio.com, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. For all of our latest coverage on COVID-19, head on over to Bloomberg.com/coronavirus. Coming up, what happened in the markets today? Tech shares gain after chipmaker merger and acquisition. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Redhead crossing the Bloomberg terminal. Early voting reaches 50.2% of total U.S. ballots cast in 2016. Wow. I can't even wrap my head around this. I mean, I'm sitting here with our producer on the show, Matt Shirley, and our EP, Barada. She's FaceTiming in, or I guess video conferencing in, videoing, is that a word, in? And she tells us in the break, to see this red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal. I said, Barada, what is it? Early voting reaches 50.2% of total U.S. ballots cast in 2016. So, I mean, I know half of the folks have already voted in America for the presidency. If you look at the batch of voters from last time. We're going to dive into that coming up in the next hour with Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from Virginia, and my all-star panel, Lester Munson. Mark Paulstenbach returns. I said, where's Mark been? We got Mark on today. But first, we got to check in with sticking with the terminal for what happened in the markets today. Tech shares rose after Advanced Micro Devices, Inc. announced a $35 billion takeover of another chipmaker, helping to blunt concern about the impact of growing coronavirus infections. Oil climbed. The tech strength wasn't enough to buoy the S&P 500 index, which declined for a second straight day. Almost four stocks fell for every one that rose, with banks bearing the brunt of selling. So that's what happened in the markets today. Joining us on the telephone line, John Authors. He is a Bloomberg opinion columnist and senior editor for markets. I've got a lot to get through with Mark. But first, make some meaning. Help me sort through the meaning of what happened in the markets today, John.
Well, basically, you've seen traders continue to act on the assumption that the coronavirus is going to be worse than they previously thought. The tech stocks, and we're not just talking about the chip merger, but you know, the big names known as the FANGs, you know, the ultra big stocks did particularly well today, and that's because companies like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and so on are seen as immune to the virus. They make even more money if we're all stuck indoors talking to each other online. While any number of stocks, particularly bank stocks, that are seen as being particularly harmed by a return to a big impact on our lives from the virus, went down. So this was a classic of what we've now unfortunately learned to live with. This is what happens when people are more worried about the virus. They buy tech.
I'm not even on my terminal. I'm on Bloomberg.com, and the lead story right now, Governor Andrew Cuomo seeks to keep 95% of U.S. out of New York as the virus rages. Wow. I mean, I can't say this enough. I mean, we this is a political show, but we kind of lose sight of just how much this virus is continuing to spread, even if it's not impacting folks' psychology of whether or not they go to their local polling place. But again, that Bloomberg headline, 50.2%.
If headlines like that are around, it is affecting psychology. As dramatically as, oh my God, we might die, which was not an unreasonable fear back in March and April, but just, do I really want to do this? Should I be making trips that are unnecessary? Maybe I am going to cancel going and seeing grandma, etc., etc. It'll have enough of an effect to move the stock markets in ways we can see, like happened today and yesterday, might yet have an effect on people, you know, the half of the country that hasn't voted yet.
A 1,000%. This is such a treat for me. John Authors is on the line. He's a senior editor for markets, and before Bloomberg, he spent 29 years with the Financial Times, where he was head of the Lex column and chief markets commentator. He is the author of The Fearful Rise of Markets and, of course, other books. Volatility is back, you write, John, on Bloomberg Opinion. Tell me about what's happening with the VIX.
Okay, the VIX, which
COVIX-19, I love it. COVIX-19! I love the wordplay. Sorry, I got to rein it in.
I should have been a downtable sub-editor at The Sun back in England, shouldn't I? So the point of the idea, VIX is you know, ultimately it's technicality. It's measuring how much people are spending on the options market to protect themselves against volatility in the future. When it goes up, it means people are more scared, which means that it is often just referred to as the fear index. And in the last few days, it has started rising significantly for the first time for an external reason other than because of, you know, technicalities I won't bore you with on this show, for the first time since the worst of the pandemic back in March. Now, a little of that is people noticing, you know, tightening in Florida and all the stuff that you will be talking about, the possibility that we'll get a tight, you know, that we'll get an indecisive election and some kind of a repeat of Florida 2000. But most of that is that people in the markets in particular really had convinced themselves that the virus was largely over as an economic issue. Choosing my words carefully. They're not saying the extent of the damage was known, and it's getting a little hard. You know, there's plenty of high-powered hedge fund managers who've been doing a lot of work educating themselves on epidemiology and... Yeah, we're largely convinced that we had reached the break point for the virus, and that's looking a lot harder to sustain given the numbers we've seen in the last few
weeks. I think this
is
fascinating. John Authors is on with us. He's a senior editor here. He's, of course, you know, a legend in financial journalism, and we're just so grateful for him to lend his time with us. You know, I ask this delicately because obviously with a week to go until the election, we're all in America very much trying to figure out what America could have done better or has done right. But you write in your column, the problem is greater in Europe, where even Germany, the most successful major European country in dealing with the pandemic so far, is seeing a rise in hospitalizations.
Yes.
And so just divorce politics for a second and just talk about the virus holistically from a European and U.S. And dynamic.
Yes, I mean, and bear in mind what it might tell us about society and the body politic that this stuff is political at all, as this is practical issues argued about between experts in public health, but anyway with no obvious ideology to them. Germany was the country that did the best job of doing a track and trace. It obviously has that much more of a tradition of actually trusting the government, and it has more of doing what the government tells it to. No bad jokes here. There is more of a culture of that in Germany than there is in certainly here in the US, but also in many other countries in Europe. And it has that much more of a tradition of the best and the brightest actually wanting to work for the government. And so they did actually do a remarkably good job of locking down relatively surgically when they did so. So 2 weeks of really not letting people move around and really cutting off the virus, and then getting it down to the kind of level where you could track and trace the victims. It was a small enough story that you could keep it contained. I mean, that's the problem that happened in many other European countries, particularly back home in the UK and here in the States, that once it gets beyond a certain level, that kind of clever stratagem doesn't work anymore. Now, in the case of Germany, we've got great economic activity data. They've not actually had true lockdowns for some months. They actually got back, if you use Google and Apple, the advantage of their knowing every single second of what we do in our lives, is we know that they can track activity very well.
Right.
Germans were back to normal.
I gotta jump in here because I have a hard break, but thank you. And I couldn't even make a Halloween Fang stock. More next. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
live from our nation's capital.
How do we reopen this economy?
The latest on how this pandemic is impacting farmers.
What does this do for the United States' relationship with China?
Bloomberg Sound On. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
We're responding to this crisis, and manufacturers are stepping up like never before.
We're looking at 70 candidates for different vaccines.
How do we make sure a pandemic of this scale never happens again?
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
1 week, one more week until the election. We've got every angle covered, plus half of the 2016 vote count has already cast their ballot in 2020. Remarkable new reporting and new numbers on early mail-in votes. What does it mean? And both candidates are on the campaign trail today. I bring you the latest, all of that, plus what happened in the markets today, and an exclusive conversation with Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from the battleground state of Virginia. 1 week to go, folks. One more week, and a red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal just within the last half hour. Dive into my terminal now as we see this. 50.2% of voters from the 2016 election count numbers have already cast their ballot in 2020. Let me just say that again. You've got 50.2% of total U.S. ballots cast in 2016. Early voting reaches 50.2% of total U.S. ballots cast in 2016. With that, former Vice President Joe Biden is back on the campaign trail today in Georgia. Biden believes this nation, he says, has to be healed. Take a listen to what he said on the trail.
Many wonder, has it gone too far? Have we passed the point of no return? Has the heart of this nation turned to stone? I don't think so. I refuse to believe it.
Meanwhile, Republicans criticizing a lack of campaign rallies from Joe Biden himself. This as President Trump barnstorms up and down the coast, barnstorms through battleground states like Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin. And meanwhile, you had President Trump, who said that he's expecting loyalty from his base. He's expecting loyalty from parts of the Midwest. Take a listen to President Trump campaigning earlier today in Nebraska. Here he is.
I'm right by Iowa and the farmers. You know, we got the farmers $28 billion. So we're very doing very well, as I understand, in Iowa and in Nebraska. But we're looking at that Omaha region. That's why we're there.
It's a fascinating, fascinating tale of two very different campaign strategies. And now we should also note that former President Barack Obama joined the campaign trail in Orlando. Here's former President Obama.
The economic damage that he inflicted by botching the pandemic response means he will be the first president since Herbert Hoover to actually lose jobs.
And if all that wasn't enough, Judge Amy Coney Barrett joining the Supreme Court last night, and the virus cases continuing to wreak havoc all throughout the country. And we should note, as I dive into my Bloomberg terminal, COVID-19 hospitalizations have risen at least 10% in the past week in 32 states and the nation's capital, as the month-old viral surge increasingly weighs on America's healthcare system, and not to mention its economic institutions. With me for the hour, an all-star panel, Lester Munson, principal at government relations firm BGR Group. He, of course, is also a former senior advisor to the former chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee. Gotta say, Lester, just got back from Nashville. Love it. Mark Postenbach returns, Democratic strategist and senior vice president at Rock Solutions. Lester, give me the lay of the land 1 week out. Is the virus going to impact the dynamics of this race? Is it going to impact turnout? Does it matter when half of America of the electorate has already voted?
Well, Kevin, it's a great question. I think the fact that so many people have voted early is almost directly related to coronavirus, right? Where our normal routines have changed. We have to plan every single move. You have to remember to bring your mask everywhere you go.
things have changed. People are voting differently this time around. I think that's a big part of the reason we're seeing so many people vote early, and you've got to track it, right? That changes the way these campaigns are working. This late push by Trump, where he did pretty well in the final debate compared to Vice President Biden, and now he's barnstorming, may not have quite the impact it would have had in a normal year when people would be waiting to vote on election day.
It's such a great point.
Everyone already,
go ahead.
The fact that everyone already voted, necessarily good for Trump.
Well, it's the question that we just don't know is whether or not the people who voted, whether or not they were going to vote already. If these are the devout political junkies, so to speak, who never miss an election. And if they're not new voters, we don't know that. We don't have exit polling on the early voting. I spoke with a Republican source earlier this afternoon, Mark Possenbach, who essentially said to me that much. They feel that the president going into town, stopping traffic, flying Air Force One, having the local media there, you know, shutting down the town, so to speak, that, you know, that that's still going to drive turnout in a way that a Biden event, a virtual event, won't be able to do. Mark, does that give you pause?
You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, this is going to come down to a couple different things. And I think one is going to be whether or not President Trump can find, you know, new voters, new non-voters like he did in 2016. You know, as you said, we're unclear right now. Which way these new voters are going to be, or excuse me, the people voting so far, which way they're going. And, you know, obviously things will be tightening over time. But at the end of the day, I'd rather be Joe Biden than Donald Trump. You know, the polls are indicating or they're going all in his favor at this point. So, you know, even though the incumbency, there are a ton of advantages there. You have Air Force One. You have the ability, you know, all the trappings of the White House and the presidency. You know, I'd much rather be Joe Biden up in a number of different states, even if it's within the margin of error.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. And it's razor thin in Florida and the toss-up states. Polls suggest that Biden has the upper hand in Pennsylvania. Buried the lead in the New York Times story where Trump is beating Hillary Clinton in the Philadelphia County, where the city of brotherly love is. Of course, so much unrest in Philadelphia as well. So many stories happening right now across the country and so many different developments. All right, just to finish off this block quickly for both of you, we got 2 minutes. So, you know, not too quick. Let it breathe, but don't take too much of a breath. Lester... You know, I'm very meditative these days. I'm very focused. You know, I do
zen.
My deep breathing.
You're very zen, Kevin.
Stoicism. You know, I read my meditations. Lester, I appreciate that. Zen. So really zen. Lester, is this Joe Biden's race to lose?
I think it is. You know, there's a Trump fatigue factor. We've seen this act for 4 or 5 years now. I think there's a certain number of people who are getting tired of it. On the other hand, they see that the Democrats have moved a little bit to the left. There might be some concerns there. Joe Biden's done a pretty good job of holding that lead in the polls. Is it going to have the same – are we going to see the same dynamic we saw 4 years ago where those polls just undercounted the Trump vote significantly? Trump has always been underpolled. His numbers have never been fantastic in polls like this. When people actually go vote, he does better.
All right.
Joe Biden's kind of been sitting back on that lead, staying, you know, at home, not doing a ton of these rallies. Is that going to be a mistake, or was that a smart move? We're going to find out in a week.
Mark, I'll get you first on the other side. Download the Bloomberg Sound On podcast on Apple iTunes at Bloomberg.com or by downloading the Bloomberg Business app. You can also find me on radio.com, iHeartRadio, and Spotify for all of our latest coverage, not just on the 2020 elections, but COVID-19 specifically. Head on over to Bloomberg.com/coronavirus. My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
The This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg TV and radio. You know, when I was growing up outside of Philly, my mother, after my birthday, she would say, "Sit down." I said, "What did I do wrong? I just turned 7. "Sit down, Kev." I go, "Okay. Write a thank you note. All right? You write a handwritten thank you note." People don't do that anymore. Mark Postenbach knows what I mean, but Mark does. Joining us for the hour, Mark Postenbach. He is a Democratic strategist, senior vice president at Rock Solutions. And I always say Rock that way. Rock Solutions. I can't help. It's so weird. Senior vice president at Rock Solutions. And because they spell it R-O-K-K, Solutions. Anyway, he's also the former national press secretary of the DNC during the 2016 presidential campaign. Lester Munson's also with us, principal of government relations firm BGR Group. You know, we got to put a final nail in the coffin, the mummy coffin. I'm in the mood of Halloween, I guess. You know, I don't know if people are trick-or-treating, but I mean, I'm socially distant. But the nail in the mummy coffin of the fiscal stimulus before Election Day. Lester Munson, it's never going to happen. I mean, I said this to Senator Kevin Cramer the other day, and I promise you we will play that interview tomorrow because we have Congresswoman Spamberger tonight. But he said it was always going to be fiscal stimulus in the lame duck, Lester, to begin with. I said, well, then why all the back and forth for the past, 6 months?
Well, there's been a lot of posturing. Everyone's got to get a message out. You know, the House under Speaker Pelosi passed a bill that everyone knew was a messaging bill. The Senate did similar things. The amazing thing for me during this interesting political process was watching the president have 4 different positions on the negotiation all within about 24 hours. It was head spinning. And a lot of conversations between Secretary Mnuchin and the Speaker. It was just a lot of chaff in the air, but no real substance.
Okay, Mark Postenbach, riddle me this. One of the things that I gathered from my reporting today was when the lawmakers told me, essentially, the election next week is going to inform the fiscal stimulus talks for the lame duck. That's very confusing. Because if we don't, I mean, we are going to get hypothetical just for a minute. If we don't have a result, they can't negotiate fiscal stimulus while they're duking it out over who's president of the United States and what the majority will be in the next election. Especially, we talk about mail-in ballots. Well, that also includes the down-ballot races. So that, in and of itself, the window's closed. Secondly, if you've got one side essentially leaving or going or coming or whatnot, I just can't wrap my head around how they will be able to negotiate a fiscal stimulus deal with this much volatility coming from the nation's capital over an election result. And most importantly, I'm not sure Americans who are craving stimulus that they can hold on much longer, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, what was said earlier is exactly right. You've got a lot of different people taking different positions. You know, Speaker Pelosi, you know, maybe thinking she's going to have a stronger hand after Election Day. You know, you've seen her sort of comments change. And, you know, the president's also saying, you know, today he promised the best stimulus package you've ever seen after the election. And, you know, the Speaker has started talking a little bit more about that as well in terms of a post-election deal. I do think it'll be interesting. I mean, at some point there will be so much pressure on Congress to do something. And logistically, is that going to be possible? But, I mean, you have, you know, the Dow sort of going down on Monday, and then it was up a little bit today. The NASDAQ was up a little bit today. The Dow is still down a little bit. At the same time, you know, you've got cases going up. So I don't know logistically how it works, but there's going to be continued political pressure, and they're going to have to figure something out and move past sort of you know, the posturing that's been taking place thus far. I just don't see, you know, how that happens. And I think at some point, too, there will be even more debate, I think, about, you know, the size of these stimulus packages. I mean, I think at this point we're at $4 trillion if you, you know, count grants and things like that. You know, the Iraq war in total was $2 trillion. So, I mean, I know that's already being discussed a little bit, but as the numbers tick up, that discussion will continue.
This is such a great panel because you've got a Republican and a Democrat who are actually talking facts and figures and policy and not just the talking points. This is my kind of show. Barada, Shirley, mark it down. We got to have this panel because in these crazy times, I mean, it's just, yeah. You mentioned the market today. Let's just do a quick market check. Tech shares rose after Advanced Micro Devices announced a $35 billion takeover of another chip maker, helping to blunt concern about the impact of growing coronavirus infections. Oil climbed. The tech strength wasn't enough to buoy the S&P 500 index, which declined for a second straight day. Almost four stocks fell for every one that rose, with banks bearing the brunt of selling. Lester, earlier in the program, we had John Authors on, who's a senior markets editor. He spent like 29 years, basically like almost my entire life, at the Financial Times, and just was the, I mean, I was kind of a little bit geeking out, like the nerd in me couldn't believe I was speaking to John Authors about the markets. But anyway, his whole point on Bloomberg Opinion, he calls it, I love this, get ready for a nerd joke, COVID-19, volatility is back. Monday saw the VIX index, which tracks how investors spend to hedge against volatility in options markets, jump above 30 for the first time since the brief but violent correction for the FANG stocks in early September. I bring this up, Lester, because we're talking about fiscal stimulus. Obviously, we're a week out from the election, and now you've got this virus and the resurgence of it, and it's resurging not just in the United States, folks. The hospitalizations are up just as dramatically in Europe, in liberal Europe and conservative Europe, all over Europe, and here in the United States. So, Lester, this volatility is back with a boom, and fiscal stimulus might be able to provide some certainty. Does Washington understand that?
Yeah, great. Again, Kevin, great question. As we've discussed, there's this expectation that this issue will be sorted out in the lame duck. There's good reason to believe that's true. We've seen in years past, Congress and the president make some tough decisions in lame duck that they didn't necessarily want to make during a campaign. So once the campaign's over, a lot of steam is let out of the pot, and you can do some things. You're right. The numbers are going up here and in Europe. There's a need. I think there's, and if we see the volatility.
And there's an expectation. Let's leave it there and return. I'm Kevin Cirilli. This is Bloomberg 99.1.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. We're joined by the Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger. She is a Democrat serving in Virginia's 7th Congressional District, Richmond, folks. Flipped Dave Bratt's district. Remember him? Dave Bratt flipped it. She got it. Now she's up against Nick Freitas, the Republican challenger in that district. Congresswoman, we got to talk policy. Thrilled to have you back on the program. But I got to ask you, what is the best / weirdest part of campaigning? Freitas, said it wrong. Nick Freitas is the Republican. What's been the best part of campaigning, or the most fun stop while you're out on the trail, as they say?
Well, you know, it's been a totally different campaign this year because of COVID, because of the precautions. Typically, where I really love to be campaigning is at events where people aren't expecting it to be political, at parades and at fairs and places where you just get to meet people outside of a campaign event. And most of those events have been canceled this year. So I'll say that while we've done a variety of different events in person, socially distanced with masks, I think one of the interesting parts about campaigning during a pandemic is all the Zoom events and roundtables and discussions that we've done, and you get to peek into people's lives and homes, and I think that there's a certain real departure from typical campaigning when you get to see people's bookshelves and family portraits on the wall.
It also can be awkward.
I'll go with that as a positive thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, I'm on all these Zooms or whatever they're called, you know, and you're on all these meetings all day long. The virtual Congressman Abigail Spanberger is with us, giving us a fascinating glimpse at a virtual campaign. And you're like hooked. You're like, what are they reading? Or who thought that framing that picture was a good idea? You know what I mean? Like, what were they wearing? Because the reporter in me just has all of these questions about their backdrop. And then you put the TV correspondent in me, and I'm like, hey, they don't have good lighting. They don't have good lighting. They don't have Christine Baratta telling them what to do. Congresswoman, you've also got three kids. And I got to be honest, you know, how's that? Are they virtually learning?
Yeah, so all three of my kids, I've got a first grader, fourth grader, and a seventh grader. They're all in virtual school 100% of the time. And my kids are in school in Henrico County Public Schools. And, you know, they've done a tremendous job of adjusting. Hats off to their teachers who have just been incredible. And so my kids have adjusted, I think, fairly well. Of course, you know, they miss the normalcy of school and everything, but I've certainly been just so impressed at how my children's teachers have adapted and have made school engaging, even in a virtual scenario.
This is so important because this, you know, for virtual learning, it's just there's such a digital divide in this country.
Oh, Kevin.
What?
Do I know about that one?
And, so, you know, tell us about this and put it in the perspective, Congresswoman, of kid trying to learn and virtual learning. Go ahead.
So I represent 10 counties through Central Virginia. We start in Culpeper in the northern portion of the district and stretch down to Nottoway County. Those 10 counties in total have made very distinct decisions about how they handle the return to school because, you know, in some of our counties, a third of kids don't have internet at home. And it is literally because where they live in the county, there is no ability to have internet in the home. So schools have been attempting to adapt. Some of the school districts I represent have done hybrid versions where kids are back a couple days and at home for the remainder of the time so that they can come home with some drives loaded up with the information that they're going to need. And it's pretty extraordinary and so difficult, the types of choices that administrators and educators are making because of the lack of broadband infrastructure that exists in their community. You know, and this is not an issue of affordability, which, of course, is a substantial issue in many, many places. But this is not the type of, problem where it can be fixed with a Wi-Fi hotspot because, you know, many of the places in my district that don't have access to broadband internet, literally you cannot have internet installed in your house no matter how much you want to pay for it, also have typically pretty poor cell service. And so, you know, we see kids who go into McDonald's parking lots, will have their Wi-Fi open. So kids and families are sitting in parking lots. And particularly during the early days of the pandemic, when public libraries were closed and schools were closed, you know, all of these ways that kids and families in communities without access had adapted were just not open to them because you can't go to the McDonald's during a pandemic to do your homework.
Anything.
So, I mean, it's significant. And this is why, I mean, since I got to Congress, issues of broadband connectivity, which is really just necessary infrastructure and an important utility the same way electricity was, you know, a century ago. Yep. And we were verging towards having connected communities and rural communities where there just isn't a business interest to connect in the same way that you do in the suburbs or more densely populated communities.
And it's
so this
something...
has been an area of focus, but the pandemic made it so that, you know, I'm getting asked about it on Bloomberg Radio.
But it's so incredibly. But Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger is with us. She is, of course, a Democrat from Virginia's 7th Congressional District, Richmond area. And it's so incredibly important. My friends over at DC Scores, I mean, just from there, they do soccer and youth literacy programs. I mean, just from their vantage point of just kids not being able to play. I mean, and you think about that, and that they don't have internet. I mean, it's something. And this is the last question I have for you. We got 2 minutes yet left, and I'm up against a hard break. But Congresswoman Spanberger, I mean, it's something that rural communities and more and city communities have in common. So it's something maybe that there could be some bipartisanship on.
You would think. In fact, we have a bill, the Accessible Affordable Internet for All Act, which gets right at this issue, which is, you know, in rural communities, the issue is you can't get internet. It's just not there. The fiber's not laid out. There's not a commercial interest there. And in some areas, it may be there, but the affordability becomes a question. And so, you know, that has been a major focus of mine. We introduced a bill over the summer. I'm a part of the Rural Broadband Task Force. And it passed through the House with our larger infrastructure bill, which, you know, as long as the United States continues to have such poor ratings on our nation's infrastructure, it's going to be vitally important that we aggressively pursue that in the new Congress. And what we did was ensure that broadband infrastructure is part of the larger infrastructure discussion, that it passed as part of the bill that we passed over the summer, which garnered bipartisan support, but of course did not move forward in the Senate.
It's just remarkable. All right, final 60 seconds. What is Richmond most famous for, Congresswoman Spanberger?
Oh, goodness. I would say our rainbow cookies.
What's a rainbow cookie? I'm hungry.
I hope my constituents don't disagree. If you grew up in the Richmond suburbs of Henrico and Chesterfield, which is my district, then you would have perhaps grown up on UCROP rainbow cookies, which are just like they sound. They are little cookies that have rainbow colors.
I want a rainbow cookie.
They are quite delicious, Kevin. They are quite delicious.
All right. Philly's got cheesesteak. Yeah. Richmond's got rainbow cookies. I love it. No, seriously. You think I'm kidding? Tell the staff I want some rainbow cookies. My many, many thanks to Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger. That was a fun one, Congresswoman. I really, really appreciate your time tonight. And diving into some policy, folks, we can still do it. We can still have a substantial policy conversation even a week out from Election Day, and yes, also talk about some cookies. Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from Virginia's 7th Congressional District, Richmond, just beautiful this time of year. Download the Bloomberg Sound On podcast on Apple iTunes at Bloomberg.com or by downloading the Bloomberg Business app. You can also find me on Radio.com, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. My name is Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Now I want cookies for dinner. Congresswoman Spanberger telling us about Richmond, the rainbow cookies in Richmond. When I was a kid, my late great grandmother, Mama Morelda, Italian side of the family, she would always bake me Italian hard rock cookies. Any Italians out there know what a hard rock cookie is? You know, it's like the size of a grapefruit, pound of butter, pound of sugar. I'm exaggerating. And then they put this glaze on it. She'd bake them for me every birthday. Italian hard rock cookies, my favorite cookie. Who's with me? Lester Munson, principal of government relations firm BGR Group. You ever have an Italian hard rock, Lester?
No, I have not. My favorite was 7-layer bars that my mom used to make way back in the day.
Ooh.
Coconut, peanut butter, chocolate, all kinds of good stuff.
Yes, that sounds amazing. Mark Postenbach, yeah. Democratic strategist. Do you ever have an Italian hard rock or a 7-layer cookie or a rainbow cookie from Richmond?
No, my grandmother used to make chocolate chip and peanut butter chip cookies, yep. And those were always the best, straight from the Midwest.
Oh, that's what I want. All right. Now it's time now for what is on the panel's radar. It's my favorite part of the show. What is on the panel's radar? Let's get focused. Let's get reset. Let's finish the race. There's only a week left. Lester Munson, what is on your radar?
Kevin, I'm watching, you know, different international crises that are going on.
Yep, so am I.
Armenia, Azerbaijan. The Egyptians and Ethiopia over this GERD dam on the Nile. There's a lot of other things going on in the world. The world keeps spinning. And while we're all focused on our political issues and campaigns, other folks are moving and might be taking advantage of our inattention.
All right, well, talk to me about Azerbaijan, because there's been the developments on this front have changed virtually every day. Why should Americans care, Lester Munson, about what's happening in Azerbaijan?
Well, it's a sensitive region. You know, these are countries basically between Iran and Russia. It's been relatively peaceful for a while. Now it's not so peaceful. The president's been making comments on it on a fairly regular basis while his diplomats are out there trying to tamp down on things. There was a ceasefire that appears to not have worked very well. So anytime rogue nations like Iran and Russia are directly involved in a conflict, we should be paying attention.
Precisely. So what should the policy be, Lester? I mean, what does the U.S. need to be doing with Azerbaijan?
I think the administration has been working hard. I think you need to see better alignment between what the president is saying and what his diplomats are saying. He tends to kind of freelance a little bit and just get out there and start shooting from the hip to make the crowds happy. That's not necessarily helpful when it comes to complex diplomacy.
Okay. All right. So that's what's on Lester's radar. What is on your radar, Mark Postenbach?
It's a good question. I think one of the things I've been trying to track is there was a couple news reports back in, I think it was April, where the RNC was, you know, doing its largest ever anti-voter fraud effort. And I say voter fraud in sort of quotations. You know, they're spending, you know, millions of dollars recruiting and training their activists to basically act as poll monitors. And they were targeting about 15,000 folks across 15 different key states. And so, you know, their goal is to, you know, challenge ballots. And basically just, I mean, in essence, sort of clog up the system on election day. And I think one thing that I'm looking at, which I haven't seen a lot of coverage of, is, you know, if you have a lot of first-time poll workers, because historically poll workers tend to be older, and if they don't want to come out due to COVID, you're going to have a lot of first-time poll workers and then a bunch of aggressive GOP activists who are going to be challenging everything. And the first-time poll workers may not be, well acquainted with the rules. So I think that's something that I think is going to be important to watch, especially
It's going to be like an open runway. You know, I've been flying a little bit, socially distant, you know, taking my COVID test and whatnot, you know, for the debates. And it's like no one's at TSA. I mean, the people who work at TSA are there, but there's no lines at the mm-hmm. TSA lines because no one's flying. I mean, when this is what's on my radar, and I think it kind of piggybacks off of Mark's a little bit. Mark Niketz, Mark Postenbach, but my colleague Mark Niketz writes on the terminal. Americans have already cast half the total votes counted in 2016 as voters show intense enthusiasm and take precautions against the coronavirus pandemics. With 7 days left to go until Election Day, 69.5 million early votes have been cast as of Tuesday afternoon, 50.4% of the total turnout from 2016. This is according to the U.S. Elections Project, which tracks early voting. That includes 46.3 million votes cast by mail-in ballots and 23.1 million in-person votes. There were 47.2 million early votes cast in all of 2016. I don't know how else to say this. 70 million people have already voted in this election. That's half of what the total turnout was last cycle. This is where I think we've got to really pay attention. The states with the highest percentage of its total 2016 vote already cast so far are Texas, Montana, and North Carolina. Wow. Nationwide, voters will not only be sent an unprecedented number of mail ballots, they are returning them sooner than in past elections. This according to a top University of Florida professor, Michael McDonald, who runs the Elections Project. This is remarkable. Of the more than 33 million ballots already cast in states that report party registration, Democrats account for 48%, Republicans 29%. Wow. And those with no party affiliation, 22%. In the battleground state of Pennsylvania, which has the highest odds of any state of being the tipping point in the election, 1.85 million Of the more than 3 million mail-in ballots requested have been returned so far, with Democrats accounting for 69% and Republicans 21%. We knew the Democrats were more likely to return their ballots via mail. The question is, folks, this is the question. Will those individuals, are there new voters in this dynamic, in this equation? Or did they already vote? Was the Biden coalition able to draw in new voters, first-time voters, get people to show up who didn't show up last time? That's what we don't know. And that's why you're seeing President Trump hold three rallies, not one, not two, three rallies in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, a state he carried in 2016, the first Republican to do so at the presidential level since 1988. So mail-in voting very much on not just my radar, but the panel's radar as well. Mark Postenbach, Democratic strategist, senior vice president at Rock Solution, of course, the former national press secretary of the DNC during the 2016 presidential campaign. Mark, any parting words on that in the minute that I have left with you?
Yeah,
like 10 seconds.
I think it's going to be very, very interesting. And at the end of the day, we'll see whether the strategy from Vice President Biden, to hold more sort of Zoom and remote events versus President Trump showing up in person, whether that will, change anything, whether that will be the decisive factor.
All right, Mark, go out there and get yourself a seven-layer cookie. You too, Lester Munson, principal of government relations firm BGR Group. Download the Bloomberg Sound On podcast on Apple, iTunes, and Bloomberg.com or by downloading the Bloomberg Business app. You can also find me on radio.com, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. My thanks to Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, of course, to John Author and Jordan Fabian at the top of the show. My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. I will catch you tomorrow on Bloomberg Surveillance. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.